You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa. Ko Manuel Toko Ingoa, no mai, hari mai ki te Wire, mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rapa Wednesday. I'm your host Manny and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined in studio by producers Toby and Theo. E whai akane, coming up on the show for our weekly catch-up with the Green Party, I spoke with MP Ricardo Menendez-March about the ongoing scandal over the government's missing emails with lobbyists and energy policy. Toby, what do you have for us today?
Today I spoke to senior lecturer in law at the University of Waikato, Dr. Amanda Turnbull-McRae, about the future of AI energy use.
And Theo, what do you have for us today?
I spoke to the Environmental Protection Authority's Acting Manager of Hazardous Substances Applications, Dr. Sean Presso, on upcoming groundwater testing for PFAS. I also spoke to the University of Auckland's Dr. Gerhard Sunborn, a member of the New Zealand Beverages Guidance Panel, on the policy brief they released this morning calling for a ban on sugary drinks in schools.
He aha o whakaro, we'd love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku patahi mai, text in on 5395. Ko wā e wareware e ahe ana koutou, te whakarongo ki anei kōrero anō, hei pakihiri rukiruki mā runga e te pai. Tukutuku o erangi poho me haere ke 95BFM ere katikom. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
Now it's time to hear from the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez-March.
The revelation of hidden correspondence shared between major New Zealand polluters and the private email accounts of those working in the Prime Minister's office has sparked a spiralling scandal. Why were the emails not revealed when such correspondence had been specifically requested if it existed? Were key law changes made specifically to end a high-profile court case against these polluters? How could the government's failure to provide such emails not be in breach of fundamental transparency rules, and what else might be hidden? The Greens now ask the Ombudsman to expand his investigation using the full breadth of his powers to determine what has gone down. And this week, the government walked back their plan to fund an import terminal for liquid natural gas with a levy or a tax on Kiwis' energy bills. While the policy is still going forward, how it will be funded remains an open question. And following the energy shock caused by the US war with Iran, the Greens highlighted their support for rewiring Aotearoa's ratepayers assistance scheme to provide cheap loans for installing home solar systems, which they say would make widespread solar uptake accessible to more Kiwis, lowering energy bills and increasing energy security. So for our weekly catch-up with the Green Party, I spoke with MP Ricardo Menendez-March about the ongoing scandal over the government's missing emails and energy policy.
Kia ora, Ricardo. Welcome back to the show. How are you going this morning?
Kia ora. Good. Yep. Getting on okay. Thank you.
All right. Last week, we talked about the scandal that's brewing around correspondence between the government and lobbyist groups and the back channels that this was going through that weren't meant to be. I want to start our conversation today with a return to that and the Greens' call to widen the scope of the investigation. Could you talk about what needs widening here?
Yeah, so I think the key thing here is that most New Zealanders wouldn't want huge corporates such as Fonterra and Enso Energy to directly be able to influence our policies and our politics through back channels. And after revelations that the Prime Minister's staffer actually handled those documents where those corporates were trying to lobby the government through private emails, which were then not able to be effectively immediately identified in Official Information Act releases and or requests. We later found that effectively the Prime Minister's office hadn't disclosed when we asked about documentation via private emails. The very specific documents have been came to light from Fonterra and Sun Energy, and we think this is quite serious because New Zealanders deserve to know who's having access to our policymakers, and this is why we've come out and called for the Ombudsman to open up a wider investigation into whether the Prime Minister's office is using private back-channel emails to deal with, say, for example, corporate lobbyists or other groups who are trying to influence our policies. And as a country that prides itself as ranking really low on the corruption levels and for having a, you know, an open democracy, we think that this would be a really good way to clear the air.
So the Green Party had specifically asked for documents such as this, sort of lobbying documents that might be going through private back channels?
That's correct. And this was over a year ago through parliamentary written questions. We effectively asked, very detailed question around documents received by staff employed in the minister's office and including through private emails. And so we were given a bunch of documents that were received through private emails, such as like a Briscoe's order, but we were not given the document specifically on, you know, the situation around Fonterra and Sun Energy trying to change our climate laws. And what this tells us is that they clearly were able to go through private emails and give us some documents that were handled through those back channels, but they did not disclose one of the more important documents, which is the one that eventually led to changes to our policies. And again, this is important because New Zealanders wouldn't expect that corporates would be able to lobby so effectively through back channels in a way that makes it harder for everyday people or for opposition MPs to be able to hold the government to account. And this goes back to the fact that we do need a broader investigation by the Chief Ombudsman over how the Prime Minister is handling, information through back-channel emails that make it harder for people to then hold the government to account.
And the Green Party, in the opposition capacity within Parliament, has full right to ask these questions. That's right.
That's right. So we can, opposition MPs, and in fact even any non-executive MP, government or opposition, can ask these parliamentary written questions to try to get information from members of Parliament. Members of the public could do official information at requests to try and get information from ministries and ministers themselves. The tools that we have just have a bit of a higher turnaround. And this is why after the revelations of how Fonterra and Sun Energy were able to effectively lobby the government through back channels and us trying to actually ascertain over a year ago what correspondence had happened through those very same back channels and not having had a response that revealed that those very same documents from corporates were part of that, we think a broader investigation is in due course to clear the air. But also because I think, again, New Zealanders would expect that governments would not be using back channels to handle information handed to them by huge corporates who ultimately end up benefiting from law changes that the government is bringing forward.
All right, let's move on while we still have time. The government walked back their plans to fund their LNG import terminal through a levy, a tax on energy bills. They say this is part of trying to keep costs down, but this is also a project that they are pushing forward through certainly some headwind, the Green Party included in that. I want to know your first thoughts about this walk back, and then we'll dive into some details.
Yeah, look, the problem with this walk back is that it's not really a proper walk back. Someone will have to pay for it, and it will most likely end up being everyday New Zealanders one way or another. And this LNG terminal should not even be explored or considered. When we've got a government telling us that there is no money to address child poverty, there is no money to actually solarize the rest of our country, when there is, they tell us that there is no money for more rapid, efficient, frequent, and more affordable trains that connect our towns and our cities, but yet they tell us there's $1 billion worth for a LNG facility. It's baffling that the government goes with climate denialist policies as opposed to the things that we know that work. And so we're going to keep a close eye on the details of how exactly the government intends to pay for it and who will pay. But what we've seen from commentators and experts is that it is still deeply likely that every New Zealander will have to pay for the costs of this LNG terminal one way or another, and that's disappointing.
Following the OECD report that saw the government change tack or speed up policy around the retirement age, which is a fundamentally large policy adjustment, there were also recommendations within that report around renewable energy, and it had skepticism around the LNG terminal as a long-term solution to any of New Zealand's issues. Do you feel like the fact that they changed tack on one of these but really poo-pooed the other of the recommendations says something about the government's intentions here?
Well, the government has never been, in my view, genuine about creating an energy sovereign nation, because if that was the case, they would be electrifying our country, they would be investing in rail, they would be investing in the things that actually help us build a more resilient economy. An LNG terminal does not do that, and it actually ends up being reliant on very, very volatile international markets. And so this is why I just don't have confidence that this is a genuine back down, but B, that this is a government that is genuinely listening to advice and best evidence when it comes to climate policies, or more importantly, actually planning for future generations ahead, not just short-term thinking or short-term slogans.
A few weeks ago, we spoke here on The Wire to Professor Basil Sharp. He's the director at the Energy Centre at the University of Auckland School of Business. And he proposed an idea of incentivising companies' capacity to produce energy more than just the energy that they produce. And this was about security, which is also what the LNG plant is for. Would the Greens' policy push for energy security, and how?
We will have more to say on our plans for energy security shortly. As you may have seen, we've long called for us to, for example, having a national electrification plan, which in and of itself also creates a more resilient energy sector. But we also think that more structural reforms need to happen, and you'll be hearing about those shortly once we roll out our election announcements.
And finally, in the Greens' press report on the LNG rollback, I saw the mention of the ratepayers' assistance policy to support solar, and I was interested what that might look like. What's the policy going on here?
Yeah, so Rewiring Aotearoa has long called for a ratepayers' assistance scheme. Basically, these are low-interest loans that could be provided and allowing people to effectively electrify their homes. And the benefit of these low-interest loans is that, A, they're far more affordable for people. And what Rewiring Aotearoa found is that the benefits in terms of, for example, seeing a decrease in your power bills, even with the sort of repayments, is that over a period of, say, 20 to 25 years, people could see a $25,000 benefit. But more importantly, they'll also see a country that is less reliant on fossil fuels, more resilient, and this is part of a plan to, like I said, electrify the whole of the country. And so we've supported the policy from Rewiring Aotearoa, and again, you'll see a theme appearing in our announcements and our policies that we're supporting, and we'll have more to say about the details of what we think assistance to ratepayers could look like when it comes to enabling them to electrify their homes.
In terms of this policy, I mean, we've seen huge solar uptake in places like Australia, and that's enabled them to work on storing the energy that is then created through solar and creating a pretty large network of possibilities. What would the possibilities open up in New Zealand if this policy was widely taken up by people?
Yes, I mean, having even something like low-interest loans with flexible terms and available actually for low-income homeowners as well would yield massive benefits to all of the community, because it's also about taking power back from the gentailers and having a community grid across the country where that electricity is not in the hands of huge corporations, will yield benefits to our communities. And like I said, this is something that we hope to have more to say on soon, but we're very committed to taking power back from the hands of the gin tailors and enabling communities to have more access to power and to do that through renewable means. And the loans for ratepayers that Rewiring Aotearoa has proposed is something that we are absolutely behind, and we'll come up with the policy details of what that looks like for us shortly.
One of the things that personally gets me very interested in this is the idea of widespread, very cheap electricity. Solar is becoming very effective in this current day and age, and very cheap to produce. Mm. There's the Lake Onslow scheme, pumped hydro, that was thrown out by this current government but is being brought back in by a private consortium. And one of the things of the scheme is effectively using cheap energy when it's not being used by the public, and times of the day when energy is very cheap and being produced through something like solar, to then pump the energy up a hill, effectively pump the water up a hill to then use it later on. Schemes like this are very interesting and would keep New Zealand's security against something like energy shocks, which this LNG plant is also trying to do. They're trying to do similar things here, but the government is choosing LNG over something like pumped hydro.
That's right. Well, and LNG is also far more vulnerable to international markets and the volatility within those, which means that, you know, going through the LNG route actually is far less stable, far more vulnerable to even, say, you know, the war in Iran continuing or completely, you know, spiraling even further out of control. And this is why looking at other solutions, including, for example, having a genuine electrification plan and one that allows all households to have access to solar energy is important. But I also want to underscore the role of central government in this electrification plan to also build our public infrastructure with solar in mind. And that looks like kind of water homes being built with solar energy, you know, solarizing our hospitals or schools, marae, et cetera. And so, yep, homeowners should have access to the low interest loans. But more importantly, I want to sort of reiterate the role of central government in investing in having the public infrastructure also solarized to make us a more resilient energy nation.
All right. Thank you very, very much for joining us this morning, Ricardo.
Thank you, Manil. I look forward to
hearing more about these electrification policies.
Awesome. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, too.
Take care.
That was the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez-March discussing the Greens' call to expand the investigation into the government's missing emails, the government dropping plans on how to fund the liquefied natural gas import terminal, and the Green support for a policy to provide cheap loans to make home solar more accessible.
That was the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez-March.
This is Hell is Around the Corner by Tricky. We'll be right back. For a soil, liquor, alcohol, falls in the juicy. Dress me up in stitsy. Hell is round the corner where I shelter. Isn't it a schism? The living out of stealth. If you believe or deceit, common sense says, shouldn't you see? Let me take you down the corridors of my life. And when you walk to, you walk to your preference. No need to answer till I take further evidence. I seem to need a reference to get residence. A reference to your preference to say I'm a good neighbor, I trust. Suggest you from my labor. The bottom ensures my good behavior. The constant struggle ensures my insanity. Passing the evenings ensures the struggle for my family. We're hungry, beware of our appetite. Distant drums ringing news of a kill tonight. The kill which I share with my passengers. We take our fill, take our fill, take our fill. I stand firm for our soil. Liquor I come for, for they juice me, seduce me. Dress me up in stitsy. Confused by different memories. Details of Asian remembrance. Conversations of what should become of enemies. My brain thinks bomb-like. So I listen, he's a calm kind. As I grow,
And as I grow collective. Before the move, sit on the perspective. Mr. Quail in the crevice and watches from the precipice. Imperial passage. Heat from the sun someday slowly passes. Until then, you have to live with yourself. Until then, you have to live with yourself. I stand firm for our soil. Lick or I come forth. They juice me, seduce me. Dress me up in stupidity.
Hands round the corner where I shelter. Living in schizos. We're living on a skelter. If you believe I deceive, then common sense says you wanna see. Let me take you down the corridor.
Thinks bomb like bomb like my brain thinks bomb like bomb like bomb like my brain thinks bomb like beware of our appetite. Thank you.
That was Computer Games by Me Sex, and before that was Hell Is Around the Corner by Tricky. Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM. Please let us know your thoughts on any of these pieces today. You can text in on 5395 or call us on 309 3879.
Well, what a phenomenal thing for you to say.
The Wire.
Last week, the United Nations released a report on the environmental cost of artificial intelligence, giving estimates for the amounts of carbon, water, and land that will likely be dedicated to powering AI in the near future. For example, the report predicts that by 2030, artificial intelligence could consume 3% of the world's electricity and require more water than the total amount drunk by the entire population of Earth annually. However, experts in AI also predict that the technology will continue to become more efficient as time goes on, requiring less electricity, water, and land to operate. To explain how all of this can be true at the same time, some people in the AI world have invoked the so-called Jevons paradox, referring to an insight from the Victorian period economist William Stanley Jevons, who noticed that the increased efficiency of steam engines went hand in hand with the increased consumption of coal. This morning, I spoke to Dr. Amanda Turnbull-McRae, Senior Lecturer in Law at the University of Waikato, about this apparent economic paradox as it relates to the future of AI. Some would argue that AI technology is bound to become more energy and water efficient as time goes on, and this will reduce the quantity of resources consumed to power it. But this isn't necessarily the lesson we should take from history, is it?
No, it's not. And actually, it's a bit of a trap. While it seems logical to think that improving AI models will make them more efficient and reduce the energy used, leaner models that deliver faster predictions using less computing, I mean, that all sounds right, seems logical thinking. But when efficiency lowers costs, what happens is that it leads to wider deployment of AI, which increases the overall AI demand and use.
So this is related to something called the Jevons paradox, right?
That's right, yeah. So it's named after an economist named William Stanley Jevons, and he lived from 1835 until about 1882, if I remember correctly. He's seen today as having had the first ecological perspective on the economy. So he wrote this book called The Coal Question in the mid-1860s. And in this book, Jevons saw that improvements in the efficiency of coal use in the 19th century England, it didn't reduce the overall consumption of coal. And what happened instead was the lower costs resulted in expanded use. And then this drove up higher overall demand for coal, which, of course, had a negative environmental effect.
Right. So he obviously understood that coal was a non-renewable resource, and he was one of the, you know, first people to raise serious questions about Britain's reliance on coal during the Industrial Revolution. And he noticed that specifically the introduction of more efficient steam engines actually led to more coal being used rather than less.
Yes.
So one person who's referenced this paradox in relation to AI is Satya Nadella, who's the CEO of Microsoft. And he referenced the paradox last year in response to news about the Chinese company DeepSeek developing an AI chatbot on a much lower budget than the American companies. He seemed as if he was celebrating this. He wrote, "Jevons' paradox strikes again. As AI gets more efficient and accessible, we will see its use skyrocket, turning it into a commodity we just can't get enough of." But you described the paradox as a kind of trap that we fall into if we don't adopt the right policies in regards to AI. So do you think that the national AI strategy launched by the government last year does a good job of avoiding this trap, or are there things that we could do better on?
Well, I think there's probably things we can do a little better. I mean, taking a light touch to adopting AI means that we're only adapting existing laws to dealing with something that's fundamentally different than our laws are meant to deal with, right? And we also have no regulator who requires or compiles AI energy use or emissions in New Zealand. So I think what the Jevons paradox tells us actually that a bit more needs to be done. We can't simply solve the environmental cost of AI by improving it, and indeed our existing mechanisms are insufficient.
Okay, so could you just expand a little more on that? I mean, what kinds of policies do you think, I mean, if you were in charge, if I make you dictator, what kind of policies are you instituting for AI use in this country?
Well, it has to be tailored for New Zealand, right? It has to be tailored for AI as well. And so that means that we recognize equally AI capabilities, but also environmental stewardship.
Which is particularly important in New Zealand. We're a small country. We rely mainly on renewables.
So, like, it's thinking about shifting our focus towards sustainable tech in the future and not just to a technological future, right? It's thinking about that sustainable part as well.
So on this idea of the expansion of the use of AI and always looking for more ways to use it, obviously in many countries, governments are looking to improve the efficiency of public service using AI. And obviously everyone's heard that there's this proposed law that would see the government use AI to make decisions on people's benefits in New Zealand. Is that going too far? Is this even necessary?
Well, as long as there's sufficient safeguards, you know, it's a balancing act, right? And this is why I'm talking about a tailored approach, is that, you know, we make sure we've adapted our existing frameworks like privacy, consumer protection, human rights. We make sure that these are adapted for an AI environment, you know, so that's sort of dealing with the software side of things. And then on the other spectrum that we've been talking about earlier is the hardware side of things, which is the environmental impact of our data centers. We need to take a balanced approach to dealing with artificial intelligence in the public sector and in the government. It's that it's not about not doing it. It's not about not getting on board. It's about getting on board safely and doing it well. So this idea of taking a tailored approach to adopting artificial intelligence and Aotearoa recognizes equally AI capability and environmental stewardship.
That was Amanda Turnbull-McRae, Senior Lecturer in Law at the University of Waikato.
Is it too late in the process, though, to change that?
Nothing's too late, bro. Everything's made up in politics.
The Wire.
This is My Leather Jacket by Miriam Clancy and Dion Lunadon, covering the chills. We're on The Wire, 95 BFM.
That was Miriam Clancy and Dion Lunadon covering The Chills' I Love My Leather Jacket. Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM. Please let us know your thoughts on any of these pieces today. Text in on 5395 or call us on 309 3879.
Children eat worms and bugs and all sorts of things when they crawl in around.
The Wire.
PER and polyfluoroalkyl substances, or PFAS, have been called forever chemicals. That's because these synthetic chemicals are incredibly durable, lasting thousands of years. This durability has made this large group of chemicals useful in a variety of industries, from cosmetics to electronics and cookware. However, PFAS have been linked to a myriad of health risks, including cancers, liver damage, and suppressed immunity. Bad news, given their ubiquity within the environment and humans. Recently, the Australian government moved to sue the manufacturing giant 3M for 2.4 billion New Zealand dollars for their use of forever chemicals in firefighting foam, which contaminated numerous Defence Force bases across the country. While no such legal action is yet on the cards for New Zealand, increased attention is being given to the presence of PFAS in our environment. In 2022, PFAS were for the first time included in the suite of compounds analysed in a quadrennial groundwater survey. However, there is still a lack of information on how present PFAS are in Aotearoa, New Zealand. So later this year, the Environmental Protection Authority will be engaging with councils and other agencies to carry out further groundwater testing to learn more. So to learn more, I spoke with the Environmental Protection Authority Acting Manager of Hazardous Substances Applications, Dr. Sean Presso. Kia ora, Dr. Sean Presso. So starting off, can you tell us just a bit about how testing and monitoring for PFAS works? So given that there are thousands of compounds, how do we go about identifying them?
Yeah, hi. So testing for PFAS is really complicated, and you're exactly right. Because of the huge number of compounds, PFAS are a class of thousands of different chemicals. We do a kind of screening test where we look for commonalities that you would get from those chemicals within the class. You can look for organic fluorine, which is a component of PFAS compounds. And then we also go into more detail and look into more depth for substances that we know are more problematic or are more likely to be there.
Right, and it must be difficult to avoid contamination of the samples when these compounds are so ubiquitous.
Yeah, so that is a huge issue and something we've come across before in our own testing from the EPA. We did have a case of contamination from our own testing equipment, which led to a false reading. And this is because, you know, in some greases you get PFAS components and machinery, and then that can contaminate your samples.
So, I mean, how do you go about mitigating something like that?
So the Ministry for the Environment has put out a really good draft guidance document on testing or for ultra-trace testing for PFAS, so at very, very low levels. And this gives you sort of advice on how to do it, how to take your blanks, what equipment you need. And basically it's making sure that everything you're using is not contaminated.
Right. And I mean, it must be tricky given that so many products use PFAS but don't necessarily have an available kind of listing of that in their product.
So I think for the sampling industry or business, there, because you have to know exactly what is in the material you're using, there's a lot more communication about what is in the stuff that is being used for those sampling activities. And that's just needed because, you know, even if you're not sampling for PFAS but you're sampling for other things, you want to make sure that you're not getting sort of false positives.
Cool. So the EPA is going to be working with councils and other agencies to carry out further groundwater testing after a survey that happened back in 2022. So how is this study that's in the plans, how is this one going to differ from the one that was conducted back in 2022?
So every 4 years, the regional councils, they do sampling of groundwater in their areas with the support from PHF Science, who organised the whole program. We're supporting that activity as well, and we did in the past, so in 2022, we asked for sampling around PFAS specifically. This time around, we're going to do that again, but we're looking for a broader range of wells. And we're looking for a slightly different combination of substances as well, but also some of the old ones, because it is interesting for us to see, do numbers change, you know, every 4 years? Eventually, we hope to build up a really nice sampling over a number of rounds where we can see what the trend might be in the groundwater.
Right, and I mean, when the analysis of these data is complete, I mean, what would you expect to see? Would you expect any levels higher than, for example, the maximum acceptable value for drinking water, or a more kind of lower rate across the country?
So I would expect to see relatively low levels, especially below the drinking water maximum acceptable value. That is what we found in the last round of testing in 2022, except for one site that was a site of known contamination that was a bit higher. But yeah, generally across New Zealand we expect low levels, but this is good for us to go out and see this and to generate that background of sampling so we know what is out there.
Right, because in the past there hasn't been, or there isn't currently, that kind of knowledge around the levels of PFAS across the country, right?
Yeah, so there's been a bit of testing done. Some university groups have done some testing. We've done this little bit of testing. We want to build up a more consistent picture and one that's across the whole country, not just in certain areas.
So how does regulation work with PFAS? I mean, what's the process behind identifying some of them as persistent organic pollutants? Both, I guess, looking at the Stockholm Convention and also for regulation within New Zealand.
Yeah, so the Stockholm Convention is an international convention that regulates certain organic pollutants, or persistent organic pollutants, or POPs. Some of these POPs that it has regulated are PFAS compounds, and this convention is designed to phase out those substances that are the most harmful, most dangerous, and stay in the environment causing harm for the longest period of time. In New Zealand, we implement the Stockholm Convention through our own Hazardous Substances and New Organisms Act, and this act also allows us to approve substances for import and manufacture in New Zealand, and that's where we can also look at different PFAS compounds and say, okay, are they approved for this use or not? And under that act, we have recently amended the Firefighting Chemicals Group Standard and the Cosmetic Products Group Standard in order to remove PFAS substances from those uses in society.
Yeah, and I guess that's kind of an interesting side of it in that PFAS had been phased out of firefighting foam entirely, partially to avoid kind of hopping from one harmful PFAS to another. So, I mean, to what extent is regulation of PFAS, given that there are, you know, thousands of compounds out there, to what extent is its regulation a game of whack-a-mole when we, you know, study one of these groups and find out that it has harmful effects and maybe transition to another one that perhaps also has these effects? I mean, is there an argument to ban this group of compounds entirely?
Yeah, so that is a risk. We refer to that as regrettable substitution, where you're just swapping out one problematic chemical for another one. And that was the reason in the firefighting foams that we banned different classes so they wouldn't switch from one class to another class of PFAS. And that's also the reason that for cosmetics, we banned the class of PFAS chemicals as a whole. Even though some of those chemicals may be fine, it was decided that the risk of regrettable substitution would be too high and that the use in cosmetics was not essential. That's something that needs to be done on a case-by-case basis, basically, when we're looking at a regulatory instrument. Does it make sense in that case, or is that not likely to be an issue? And that's, you know, we need to make that assessment before a decision is made.
Right, and I mean, I guess we wouldn't want to be jumping the gun on anything if there aren't actually any detrimental health impacts to it. But to what extent, I guess, is there kind of proactive research into these areas? I mean, are you able to do quite broad research, I guess, internationally on large groups of these compounds, or is it more, like, specific?
So both. I think internationally there's a huge amount of research going on both, like, PFAS compounds as a class and contamination and environmental risks, but also individual PFAS compounds and the effect that they might have on the human body or in the environment. And with that information coming in all of the time, we're keeping tabs on that to see things that may be relevant or not relevant for New Zealand and seeing how that may impact our own position on certain substances. We're pretty lucky in New Zealand. We haven't had the huge contamination issues that they are seeing overseas, particularly around industrial sites or manufacturing sites. And so generally we have a fairly low level, or quite low level of PFAS in the environment here.
That was the Environmental Protection Authority's Acting Manager of Hazardous Substances Applications, Dr. Sean Presso, on PFAS testing and regulation in Aotearoa, New Zealand.
So around, you know, up to 8 or 10,000.
Shit.
The Wire.
Sugary drinks, such as fizzy drinks, flavoured milk, and energy drinks, are a favourite for many children across the country. However, this consumption of high sugar drinks is proving harmful, with dental issues, heightened risk of diabetes, and other health issues tied to these drinks. Aside from this, sugary drinks are still readily available to children across Aotearoa, New Zealand, even within their schools. This morning, the New Zealand Beverages Guidance Panel published a policy brief calling for the ban of sugary drinks from school grounds, prohibiting them from being purchased or brought by students into schools. So to learn more, I spoke to the University of Auckland's Dr. Gerhard Sunborn, a member of the New Zealand Beverages Guidance Panel, on the policy brief they released this morning calling for a ban on sugary drinks in schools. Kia ora, Dr. Gerhard Sunborn. So first of all, I guess, what are the harms that we're seeing with sugary drinks in schools? Dental issues and increased risk of diabetes seem the obvious ones, but are there any that you've been kind of surprised by, or that might take people by surprise?
Yeah, other issues, but I suppose, you know, the most obvious one is issues around dental health and, you know, children having their first teeth and some of their permanent teeth damaged. You know, my wife is an oral health therapist, and she's seen preschoolers who've had, you know, half of their teeth have got caries in them. So that's the big one that we see in children straight away. But you know, like you said, there's high risk in children who drink a lot of sugary drinks of developing diseases like type 2 diabetes, but also later in life heart disease and things like gout. But one thing that also happens is having a lot of sugary drinks, it impacts children's learning and concentration and causes behavioural problems as well. So that's kind of well known around sugary drink intake as well.
So how even are the harms here? Are we seeing these health issues present quite evenly across communities, or are some better insulated than others?
Yes, so I think there is a trend, you know, those in with higher deprivation, in areas of higher deprivation, experience most of these poor health outcomes more so, and are more likely to consume more sugar and more sugary drinks. But the issues are that widespread that they impact all children in New Zealand and in all communities. You know, so we have, New Zealand has one of the third highest rates of childhood obesity as to do our adults. You know, so if you have obesity in childhood, you're more likely to have an adulthood. So some communities in around high deprivation experience it more so, but the impacts are across the board in the whole of New Zealand.
So the term sugary drinks seems kind of synonymous with fizzy drinks, but it includes far more than that, with flavoured milks being an example. Are there any sugary drinks that are currently kind of flying under the radar, so to speak?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's things like energy drinks and even flavoured waters that actually have a high percentage of sugar in them. And also to fruit juices, 100% fruit juices and fruit drinks, they have similar amounts of sugar in them compared to a fizzy drink. And in some cases, like apple juice, maybe even a little bit more sugar in them. And although they're not added sugars, they still have the same impact of rotting teeth and increasing risk of unhealthy weight, type 2 diabetes, and causing, you know, problems in concentration and learning. So it's not as simple as it seems in terms of, you know, what are, you know, is it just fizzy drinks that are sugar drinks? No, there's other drinks that are got high amounts of sugar in them as well.
Yeah, I mean, like when I was at high school, which is a little while ago now, we got an up-and-go vending machine with flavored milk, which is, of course, marketed as kind of healthy or nutritious. What role does marketing play in how kids are interacting with sugary drinks?
Marketing is huge. You know, and some of the best marketers in business and in industry are beverage companies. You know, and there's some obvious ones. Sure everyone knows, but yeah, you know, marketing of these drinks is huge. It does influence behaviour and awareness, and it does drive up consumption. So yeah, I think we've got to be aware of those types of things, and there are rules and regulations around it, but it's quite hard to you know, push against that type of stuff.
So within your policy brief, you've talked about banning sugary drinks from school grounds. Now, how effective would you consider this approach to be if no other kind of meaningful action has taken place outside of schools? So, for example, if there's like a dairy across the road that kids can go to after school to buy sugary drinks.
Okay, yeah. So ideally, you know, it would be great if we could have greater influence on the environment, you know, the broader environment. But that's difficult. But I think, you know, by getting sugary drinks out of schools, at least it's a step in the right direction. And we know that, you know, children are in schools for around 6 hours a day, and so at least they're not going to be exposed to consuming sugar and high sugary drinks while they're at school. But also too, if you have a regulation or a policy implemented like this from government, it sends a clear message to the community, which is the parents, the kids, everybody, that these drinks are not good for children. You know, so there's another added benefit that it raises awareness more broadly about sugary drinks not being good.
Right, so this is kind of like a step towards that maybe ultimate goal of greater reductions of sugary drinks in our communities.
Yeah. And you know, other mechanisms to try and reduce sugary drink intake are needed. You know, we think, you know, things like a sugary drinks tax and better labelling, how many teaspoons of sugar are actually in that drink, would also help. But I think in the current environment, you know, I think that this getting sugary drinks out of schools as a first step and an obvious step, you know, I don't think any child should be encouraged to have, you know, a can of drink that has around 11 teaspoons of sugar in it at school, you know, especially when there's alternatives that they can have. So I think this is a absolute obvious, and I think it's a no-brainer that we should get them out of schools as a first step and an important step.
Right, and what kind of government engagement are we seeing with this issue so far? Because I know that you've been, the New Zealand Beverage Advisory Panel has been putting out policy briefs for a while now. What kind of progress are we seeing being made by government?
Okay, yeah, so there's been a push for water-only schools, and we supported that as well. The previous policy brief we wrote, we had a symposium, a summit down in Wellington opposite Parliament, and the policy brief was about water-only schools. A lot of primary schools have gone water-only. We thought in 2023 there was a consultation under the previous government where they were looking at implementing and regulating properly around water-only schools, but unfortunately nothing happened. It fell over. And so I think this new policy brief, which is about sugary drinks for schools, it means that it's not just saying water only, because I think it makes sense, you know, primary schools are more open to having water only policies, but high schools it becomes more difficult. So the policy around sugary drink free schools will mean that low sugar and zero sugar drinks will be able to be consumed and that will be acceptable in the schools, but they need to be low sugar. So it's kind of, I think it's more likely to be implemented it's a more realistic policy that we could hopefully get through all schools.
Right, yeah, more of a kind of harm reduction than... So,
because it's the sugar in the drinks is what's causing the damage, you know, mainly, you know, in terms of dental caries and metabolic issues and behavioural things. So if we can get the sugar out of the drinks, that's the biggest harm, you know, it's a step in the right direction.
So I guess on that note of reduced sugar drinks, how would you characterise the industry engagement in this area? Because, I mean, often with other commercial determinants of health, harm reduction approaches may not be adopted with, you know, open arms, to say the least, thinking about like the concerted lobbying campaigns by alcohol and tobacco industries. So what kind of engagement have we seen with sugary drinks?
Well, yeah, that's a good question. And the thing is, industry ahead of government in this issue. And so since 2017, the New Zealand Beverage Council, who represent the majority of beverage industry here in New Zealand, they have a policy where they'll only sell, or their members will only sell water, bottled water, to the primary schools, and they'll only sell they won't sell full sugar drinks to intermediate and high schools. So they have policy stopping the high sugar drinks getting into primary and secondary and high schools. But the thing is, it doesn't have a lot of impact because most school canteens and tuck shops, the people who operate those usually buy their drinks directly from supermarkets, not from the beverage companies. So these drinks still come in, you know, but you know, since 2017, industry have had policy to stop, you know, these drinks from getting into the schools. But on the flip side, you know, if a canteen operator brings them in, there's nothing to stop them from coming in from the educational or the Ministry of Health side, if you see what I mean. So I think if we could get this policy, sugary drinks in schools, in place and regulated by government, it would mean that the government is kind of coming up to the same level as what industry are at now in terms of the policy they already have.
That was the University of Auckland's Dr. Gohard Sunborn, a member of the New Zealand Beverages Guidance Panel, on the policy brief they released this morning calling for a ban on sugary drinks in schools.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te ho tāka katoa mo tēnei wiki, nei te mihi ki e koutou katoa I kororo mai ki mato mo tēnei rā. That's a wrap for The Wire on Rapa Wednesday. Thank you to all of our guests, the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez-March, Dr. Amanda Turnbull-McRae from the University of Waikato, the Environmental Protection Authority's Dr. Sean Preslow, and the University of Auckland and New Zealand Beverage Guidance Panel's Dr. Gerhard Sunborn. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in. You're listening to 95 BFM. Next up is The 1-4 with Bridge. See you next week.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.